gentlemen, we're going to get started in just 1 minute, so if you can come forward and find your seats, that would be great. Please come forward, take a chair. Okay, good for you. All right, well, welcome everybody. My name is Paul Yock. Glad you're here for the Innovators Workbench. We have what I think is going to be a really terrific program. Before we start, I wanted to let you know about a kind of special circumstance for this afternoon. So many of you are aware, we're going ahead with the Innovators Workbench program without one of our key founders and guiding lights, Tracy Lefteroff. Tracy started this program with us 12 years ago and was actively involved in picking the speakers, supporting the program, celebrating the speakers in classic Tracy fashion. As we thought about his passing and the impact on the field, we thought it would be a fitting tribute to have one of these sessions each year dedicated to the memory of Tracy. So that is this afternoon's session. We are very grateful to Casey McGlynn and Wilson Sonsini for sponsoring this. The co-sponsors are the By Design Program and then the Lefteroff Fund at the Fogarty Institute. The Institute and By Design have been working closely together for a while. There's this nice synergy going on where some of the fellows and students from the By Design program go on to the Fogarty Institute to develop their companies further. A big reason for the success of the Institute is Ann Fife, the president and CEO, and Ann is here just to talk a little bit about the Institute, but more specifically about the Lefteroff Fund that's been raised in the Institute. So, Ann.
Good. Thank you, Paul. I am Ann Fife, and I'm president of the Fogarty Institute for Innovation. And this is a great tribute to Tracy. For those of you that might not have known Tracy, he really did have an incredible impact on our industry. And he was on our board at the Fogarty Institute, and he really was one of those people that took the time. We have a lot of early stage ideas at the Institute, and Tracy was the one that would not only come in and sit down for a moment, he would do the next intro and the next intro, and really had a real impact, I think, for all of us. So in setting up the Lefteroff Fund, Tracy worked for Price Waterhouse. He was also on the board of the California Healthcare Institute, and then, as I mentioned, he was also on the board of the Fogarty Institute. And so when Tracy passed away last fall, everybody was trying to create some sort of a fund. And in fact, it was Mike Musollam from Edwards who said, of all of you doing it separately, why don't you pull together and do something together? So Price Waterhouse put in the first seed funding of about $150,000. Dr. Fogarty put in $100,000. And then from there, we have continued to raise funds. We've worked very closely with Tracy's wife, Jennifer, and his brother, Kurt. And so it's been nice to have their input as well. So it was really set up and established to really further Tracy's vision for medical innovation and to honor his contributions, not only as a leader in the field, but an incredible mentor to people, and also as a very dear friend. So we set up an advisory board that has members from Price Waterhouse, California Healthcare Institute, the Fogarty Institute, Hank Plain. We have a lot of different industry leaders that are on that also to set up what we were going to do. So basically the mission is to invest in individuals, programs, and early stage ideas that will create the next generation of not only medical innovation, but medical innovators. Both Dr. Fogarty, who founded the Fogarty Institute, and Tracy really shared this passion that with all that's going on in this country that makes it so difficult for medical innovation, whether it's the FDA or the lack of financing, that we really want people to continue, particularly young people, to be involved in medical innovation. So the Lefteroff Fund, we looked at what to do. Should we start it from scratch? But it seemed like it was a natural fit to go into the Fogarty Institute. We really are completely based on medical innovation to improve patient care. It is a nonprofit. We now have about 13 companies, believe it or not, at the Fogarty Institute. And we're housed on the El Camino campus. And we have everything from cardiovascular. We have 5 companies now in the mother, infant, early stage of life. And so anyway, it's a great platform. And it seemed to fit well with what we were trying to do with Lefteroff. He was a board member, as I mentioned, but I think the best thing is it's a 501c3 educational nonprofit, and our whole goal is mentoring, training, really helping early stage entrepreneurs and concepts get to market. So it was just easier to put it with, within the Fogarty Institute than to start separately. So we have 2 categories. It really falls into education and innovation. For education, it will be funds, and every year we'll pick recipients, whether they're high school, college, graduate students. We even have some physicians that are coming in. And this summer, we have 10 that will be arriving at the Fogarty Institute that will be part of the Lefteroff Awardee Fund. And then we also do things like the biodesign, and we really appreciate Paul and Gordon and others partnering with us to be able to do this workbench series. And then we also look at innovators. So we're looking at people that have early stage ideas that we can help with their funding to help them get launched too. So we have gone through the advisory group, the first recipients and the first applications, and we'll be announcing in June who these will go to. So a portion of the funds will be allocated in June, and it'll be something we'll do on an annual basis. So anyway, we're very excited about it. I think when situations like this happen, and you have someone who had such an impact on our industry, it's really important to keep that spirit alive, and that's what we're hoping to do with the Lefteroff Fund, is to recognize Tracy and all he has done, and to have that live on with what we're all doing. So, thank you.
All right, so as our main event comes to the stage, let's see, 2 announcements. One is there'll be a reception in the back of the room at the end of our session, so please join us for that. David will ask for questions at the end of the talk, so in the last minutes, kind of formulate the question that you'd like to ask. Oh, yeah, and of course, please turn your cell phones to vibrate. So it is a great pleasure to have back David Kasich, who is going to introduce our speakers for this afternoon.
Great. Well, thank you, Paul, very much. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold here. It's a great pleasure to take us through the PVT story today. It's really just one of those very interesting stories of taking an idea that seemed so counter to all the, current thinking about medical care, taking a pioneering physician, 2 very dedicated, 2 pioneering physicians, but one, Alan Cribier, 2 very dedicated med tech executives, and creating just a fabulous story. So on my far left, your far left, is Stan Rabinovich. And to my immediate left is Stan Rowe. So the most difficult thing tonight will be keeping the 2 Stans. This will be a challenge for me to figure out who I'm addressing in any given time, because even Stan R doesn't really work in this thing. And Stan Revenge told me they have different middle initials, but I'll never keep that straight. So we're going to try to work through this. But let me begin, actually, prior to the PVT story, with another company, Johnson & Johnson, because it's actually instrumental in a lot of ways to the PVT story. And Stan Rowe, I'm going to begin with you. How do you started at, the story really starts at, even prior to Cordis, Johnson & Johnson's initial effort in cardiovascular, a company called Johnson Interventional Systems. How did you get to Johnson & Johnson Interventional Systems, JJS, and what did you do there?
Well, I joined J&J from Cordis, and so I was the director of marketing at Cordis Corporation, and obviously very interested in interventional cardiology.
This was how many years before
this
J&J
acquired? Three years before.
Before
the acquisition. It was 9 years before.
9 years.
So in 87, I joined Cordis and worked with them, and they didn't have any... They were the leading company in diagnostic catheters, but they had no interventional products. So my job was to get them into interventional cardiology. And so we put together the teams and did the first guiding catheters and balloon catheters and other products that they worked on. And then ended up leaving there to, my wife and I both joined JJIS, but Stan was already there. But this was my second stint at no pun intended, at J&J, and I had spent 6 years before developing anesthetic drugs at Janssen Pharmaceutica.
Oh, I see. I didn't even realize you were there prior to that. And just before we get to Stan's, Sarah Bunich's role at JJS, you played a role later in the Cordis acquisition by Johnson & Johnson, but when you joined, did you have any inclination that at some point Cordis would be part of Johnson & Johnson?
No, no clue at all. We, you know, our job was kind of heads down, make it work, and that's what we focused on. And it took a while, and there were some tough periods there too, great learnings. The first time we went to panel, we got turned down, and a lot of people forget that. But it was a very long ride from Washington, D.C. back to New Jersey with Marv Woodall.
So Stan Rabinowitz, you were, as Stanton points out, you preceded him actually at JJS. How did you get to JJS and what were you doing there?
In 1979, I joined one of J&J companies. I worked with J&J for 17 years, but the first one was it was called Technicare. Remember, Paul? And it became Johnson & Johnson Ultrasound, so I was working there and that it was in Denver, and then we acquired a company in New Jersey called IRIX Ultrasound, and that's where I moved to New Jersey. And if some of you remember the Tylenol case, after the Tylenol case, I think J&J decided to get rid of all imaging technologies and companies, so I joined another J&J company called Sight Microsurgical, where I met Marv Woodall. And when Marv moved and became president of JJIS, he invited me to join the company as a manager of or special project.
You're an engineer by training.
I'm an engineer by training, and the most interesting thing is that I have, I am in EE, I'm master in electrical engineering, and this was my specialty. And when I was when Marv invited me to join him at JJIS, it was very interesting. It stands, it's mechanical. But we had one project called Hemopump, so, but anyway, it was very interesting. There was a lot of projects that I was involved with. I could apply some of the knowledge of special ultrasonic angioplasty or some way to find a way to make it.
So both of you eventually became involved with the Palmol shot stent, which Johnson & Johnson pioneered and introduced. There seemed to be a lot of resonances with the stent, experience stents, and what you would later do with percutaneous valves. Talk about your experience with the stent and how it may have shaped or informed or influenced the way you later approach percutaneous valves. I tee it up for both of you.
You know, I think we were all learning a lot. I mean, when I first started working on coronary stents, I would go talk with interventional cardiologists, and they would say, are you kidding me? You can't put stainless steel in someone's coronary artery. It'll thrombose. They'll die. That's an idiotic idea. And of course, we were kind of, I guess we were concerned. And we treated, I think as Gary Rubin and his group did, we treated abrupt closure because it seemed like a better idea than perfusion catheters, but it was in treating dissections, which became abrupt closures. So we learned a lot about this technology, but we were the first to go after restenosis as an indication. That was really the big step, is to go from that niche of understanding, you know, this very acute environment to go into preventing restenosis was fundamentally different. And we went through huge trials and tribulations. Many of you who may have not have lived through this, in the early days there was a New England Journal of Medicine article, which I remember vividly, which was said that there was about a 30-something percent incidence of acute and subacute thrombosis, and it almost killed stenting.
And in fact, the editorial in the New England Journal advocated against putting stents in.
And J&J almost shut the whole place down, right then. But we begged and pleaded, and what we ended up doing was throwing the kitchen sink at these patients. We gave them heparin, dipyridamole, aspirin, dextran, and Coumadin. That's all. So we gave them that to keep them from clotting, and then we expected their groin to close. So it didn't make any sense. And of course, we had 30% incidence of groin side complications. So, you know, we learned a lot of really tough lessons then. We also learned a lot. Stan pioneered an industry that became a local legend here. Why don't you tell them about that?
As I told you, there were a few projects that Marv wanted me to do, and one of them was to find new way to make stents. If you remember, Palmer shot stents were made by using EDM project. A process. It's aqua discharge machining. It's like you burn the stuff. So I tried to find a way, and one of the things that we find the right partners, and we were able to create the first laser manufacturing of the stents. So, and I will never forget in 94 when I was at the Germopre meeting in Paris, and I was able to. There was a slide. I was a part of presenters, and I had my slides, and I was able to show. And I said, guys, not just I can make different kind of shapes of stents, we can even engrave the name of the patient or the name of the whatever. So it was very interesting. But anyway, it was kind of revolutionary. And the most interesting thing was there when we tried the very first one, a prototype was built together with the guys from Symbiosis. Then I had to identify the person or the company who will be able to build the very first laser manufacturing system for us for prototyping. And I had a couple of them, and one of them was very, very local one here. I came across with one guy who had in the garage a nice laser machine, and a very small company called LPL Systems, which is in Mountain View, and they had only four people. He didn't know a lot about stents, but he knew a lot about the laser cutting. And the tubing. So, and of course, together with George and some other people who came, by the way, from this great university, continued this process. They're still there. And Luminous, I don't know if you know, Todd Dixon came from, and he continues to do it. So the whole thing I have to tell is that the first laser cut stent that was available was cut here in the beautiful area of California. And then in 94, I have to mention it, in 94, when we were in Paris at this meeting, Germopre, after my presentation, we had a breakfast, Stan and me, and he said, Stan, it was Stan's idea. He said, why not to make a self-expanding stent? So it's a great idea. A wall stent at that time existed. And there was another company, if you remember, Angiomed. They used to take nitinol wires and they weld them. That was the kind of one of the stents. And so we came. It was January and March of 94. I went to see the company called NDC. They just started very small. They just left Rakem. It's your neighbors too, I guess, in Fremont. And there was like 5-7 people, and I told them, guys, how about let's try to make a stent from nitinol tubing. They said, you know, we have nitinol tubing. We know how it works. We're making the frames for eyeglasses. but we don't know how to cut it. And I introduced them, and the first ever nitinol stent was made. Like, I still have it. It looks like the Palmer shot stent, so. And it's been here.
In addition to the enormous skepticism, jumping ahead a little bit here, because we have to get back to the PVT story, but the other thing which the early stent experience, well, I guess more angioplasty itself with PVT, was the early clinical, some early failures and difficulty of getting this thing. It wasn't as if PVT, wasn't as if percutaneous valve, you know, was a clear and obvious success at the very beginning. Did anything you experienced at JJS, I guess, particularly you, Stan, because you were there for so long, resonate with you later when you went through the very early development stages of JJ?
If you'd like to switch to PVT, then it's a little bit different. It's the way when we met Alain Cribier and what actually happened. If you're talking about that we brought this to J&J, that's what you would like to cover.
Yeah.
It was at the time when I think we met Alain Cribier with this crazy idea. We were at JJIS. It was before Cordis acquisition. And Stan and I, we were in Paris. We met him, and he gave us in slides a couple of presentations. He said, I have this crazy idea, and guys, can you provide me with stents? And I need large stents, so I can do some study and, you know, with animals and see if for retention, all this stuff. So we provided stents to him. And then he was showing with these slides going all over the world, said, guys, it's going to work. We can't place stents in cadaver heart, and you cannot remove it, and let's do it. So he went to a lot of different companies. The bottom line was that I think we decided at JJIS that this is a great opportunity, and the great champion of this one was Stan. He said, absolutely. He went to the top guys, and the bottom line was, and it happened during the time when we were acquiring Cordis. And it was in 96. And during this time, a lot of things were kind of, a lot of the top management of JJS started leaving the company because the integration was absolutely terrible and people started leaving. But the bottom line, what we did, we signed an agreement with Alain Cribier that between JJS, or even I think the contract was JJS, it didn't switch to Cordis yet, and Alain Cribier, that J&J will develop the percutaneous heart valve. Stan left, I joined him later in January 97. And to make story short, I think to answer your question is, 1.5 year later, we got a call from Alain Cribier, and he said, guys, J&J did nothing. Are you interested?
So let me just fill in a little bit and just say, I think Stan and I both learned tremendous amounts about the biology of stents, the challenges of making them. We learned, I certainly learned, continued to learn a lot about interventional cardiology. I used to go spend time at Washington Cardiology Center and watch them do all kinds of cases. And, you know, those guys were phenomenal. They would treat me like a fellow. And, you know, it was a great experience to really refine so much of my knowledge of that area. But after we got an approval, which was not easy, finally, for the Palmes stent in the U.S., and just for those of you who don't recall, the very first year of sales for JJIS was $650 million. We drove J&J earnings, and there were about 120 people in the company.
Yeah.
It was pretty astounding, and they thought it was dumb luck. And therefore, we had, you know, we couldn't build something endemically. We needed to go outside and buy something else. And that's where we ended up going after Cordis. We actually made a run at Guidant, but it was too complicated, and they decided against it. I was part of the acquisition team.
We being Johnson made a run.
J&J.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, we did have an opportunity. So after the launch, I formed a group to do advanced technology, business development,
Strategic planning,
and for a while clinical research, and so we were looking to figure out how to build it. And we started with a Hepicoat stent. We developed that. We started the drug-eluting stent, which became Cypher. We actually had licenses to both the paclitaxel and also rapamycin. We had both, and then lost them later. But we were way ahead of the game, way ahead of the game. Part of the way we were ahead of the game is we also saw the percutaneous valve, and we were very interested. And it was a nice introduction, and it was worth the minor investment that we make. But we were very interested to see, you know, to take the first early steps.
By licensing the technology from Alcon, yeah.
So we did. J&J filed the first patents from
Cribier. Yeah, we did file this for Cordis, right. That's what we did. Help, right? And I think there was quarterly payments of $30,000 something for 2 years. That's it, nothing else. And J&J supports, at that time, Cordis is supposed to develop together with Alain and with Hector.
And I want to get to the fourth member of PVT because he was also at JJIS. But Stan Rabinovich, you mentioned that Alan had showed his technology to other companies. Do you get a sense that Johnson & Johnson was the only company that was seriously looking at percutaneous valves in the late 90s?
But that's what you can hear from all the presentations that you make. They approach any company, St. Jude and whatever, just
they
name it. Nobody believed in this one. And J&J didn't believe it too, it's us. We believed it a little bit more, and Stan was able to convince the company just to sign the agreement for develop. It's just 2 year agreement. It wasn't nothing licensing. Yes, we applied in exchange for they working with us. We signed this agreement that J&J we're internally will develop it. But we left.
But it was early feasibility. You understand? It was a minimal commitment, and I had it pretty much within my purview that I could do that level of investment. But it wasn't the first time. I mean, when Henning Root Anderson took his first concept out, he got turned down by everybody too. So there was a good precedent for people thinking this was a completely ridiculous idea. And we were the only people who were gullible enough to really believe that it was possible.
So we'll get the Anderson patents in just a bit, but there is a fourth founder of PVT who we talked around, and not that you need any rationale for bringing Marty on to any kind of project, but what role did he play in? And if Alan is pushing this and you guys are kind of doing the business development and the technology development, what role did Marty play in early development?
You want me to say?
Go ahead.
Well, just in the time frame, and I will give it to Stan. We just talked about the agreements that J&J signed with Alacrity to develop. We left, Stan and I, out. 1.5 years later, we got a call from Alacrity. Guys, J&J did nothing. No interest. Are you interested in? Then Stan and I decided, let's talk. Let's go and talk to Marty, and that's what we did.
So Marty, why Marty? Yeah. Why did you?
So Marty was my medical director.
Right.
He was at JJIS. So I did the stress trial with him. So there are two big restenosis trials, the stress trial and the Benestent trial that were published back to back in the New England Journal, and I had a lot more to do with the stress trial than I did the Benestent trial, although I was very involved with Petri at various levels. But Marty and I got to be good friends and learn how to argue together to bring the stress trial to fruition, because it was floundering when I picked it up. And so I had a lot of respect for Marty, as I know Stan did. So we kind of bounced this off of him. What do you think, Marty? And Marty said, you know, this could work. It's interesting. And we had a meeting in Barcelona, I think.
It was later.
But we were, you know, Cribier was frustrated, and he was a guy who was completely determined to do something after balloon valvuloplasty had failed. And that's an important setting for people to understand, is that Alain Cribier was the founder of balloon aortic valvuloplasty. Mm-hmm. And this was very popular during the late 80s, but then the restenosis rates were found to be 75%. And so it ended up being an abysmal failure long term. It was palliative, but not the therapy they hoped it would be. And so this was Alain's dream of you know, really treating this disease when balloon valvuloplasty had failed.
So July 21st, 1999, the four of you launched PVT. What was your first issue? I know that, how soon did the issue of raising money become an issue for you?
Okay.
What were you, talk about July 21st, 1999.
Let me talk about the June of 99. When we got together, of course, we decided, you know, we didn't talk about PBT. There wasn't a company. There was the name of the company. It was just we decided to have a collaboration. There will be two engineers, two physicians, you know, guys, we signed kind of interesting paper, four of us, so let's collaborate. And then we decided we had an idea who can develop this stuff. We had a couple companies who will help us to develop. But then we decided we have to raise money. And it's happened that in June, Allah called us and said, you know, I have to pay the maintenance for my patent. And it happened that Stan and I were attending the International Symposium of Intervention Cardiology Symposium in Jerusalem. We went there and we knew some people there and they introduced us to a couple VCs. We presented the case, then we had 7 or 8 slides. And we present and they look at us like you're crazy, and one guy's are in technology, another guy's in medical, that's completely out. And then one guy told us, you know, there's one company in engineering company in Caesarea, and they just hired the guy. It's an engineering firm, 85 engineers. They do everything, irrigations, whatever, mechanical, plastic, electronic, 85 engineers. And they just hired the guy who came from Medtronic, and they would like to invest in medical devices. So Stan and I went there, we made this presentation, and whatever, came back, and there was a note, a message to Stan, from the company, guys, we're very interested, but we not just want to invest in your company, we would like to help to develop it. That's how the whole thing started. So it was end of June, so it's June 30th. We came back on July 21st, we formed and officially, you know, for Cutaneous Valve Technology, Inc. We got this in Delaware, we got our lawyers. And then we had the first meeting, of course, in Barcelona, and that's it. And the guys, by the way, start meeting with Allah and trying to figure out how it works and everything else. And in December 15th of 2000, we signed a 3-page agreement with these companies that in January of 2000, they will start working on the project. And the money, when we'll get money, we're going to pay you. But meanwhile, we don't have anything, so.
They actually started in January.
So did you launch in July with no capital? Just you had an engineering.
What do you mean, like, we paid the registration.
Oh, we just filed the corporation.
We filed the corporation, $120, I forget. Yeah.
We started, the engineering started in January of 2000 with Iran R&D. And
right.
Abi Zakai was the head of that group, and he was instrumental in us getting started. And we reached a very amicable agreement with him. You know, I always say the idea of doing contract engineering was really a fundamentally bad idea. So we didn't do regular, our agreement was not contract engineering. And I said to Abby, I said, you know, contract engineers have really, you know, one goal, take longer, right? I mean, it's a bad incentive, right? And so I said, look, Abby, here's the deal. So we'll pay you money, but I want you to just break even. And anything that you would make in profit, I'll give to you in warrants. And that was the deal we structured. And we did it in milestones. We did a milestone-based deal. And we structured it so that he broke even, but he got some warrants. And so they worked for about 18 months.
Correct. When you form, but it's
that way. And the other thing that I always despised about contract engineering, I was going to teach their engineers a whole hell of a lot, and then they were going to go away. So I got him to agree this time that I had a call on his engineers.
To hire them.
And that's what I did. At 18 months, Stan and I sat down with him and hired all of his medical device engineers away from him. But we set up the headquarters in Iran, kept it there,
and
it ended up being a really nice way for us to start. And,
it's PBT Ltd.
You did raise a little bit of angel money early on.
It's in the summer. We talk about now January. Yeah. They start working in 2000. By the summer of 2000, we raised first money from angels.
How much did you raise?
We raised $500,000.
From a bunch of mostly interventionalists.
Interventionalist couple ourselves, and I think people who kind of...
Well, Marty, Stan, and I could do it. Alain had no money, so he contributed his patents.
Patent to us, so, but we did, and then mostly interventionalists, so guys who kind of, I think, it's very interesting to hear it. I don't want to brag about it, but the idea was interesting, but I think they mostly believe in... That's what they told us, at least in Stan and Stan, so I don't know. But I think we have a good reputation to help us a lot to raise for money because it was a very crazy idea.
So at some point, you guys are going to need to raise some real money because it's somewhere around this time that the Anderson patents come into the story. Alan Cribier's original technology is based on his own patents, but you guys early on identified the Anderson patents as critical. Why were the Anderson patents critical? And tell us the story of how you came about to acquire those patents.
Well, I studied the Anderson patents when I met Cribier, so I did my patent diligence. I actually had an MD, JD, who worked for me, who was really good, and as soon as I came back and thought this was interesting, I said, okay, go find everything you can, let's sit down and go through it, and I find the Anderson patents that have been filed that weren't issued. And somehow I run down Henning's phone number, and I call him in Denmark. So here I am calling some guy in Aarhus, Denmark. I didn't even know where Aarhus was. And I picks up the phone. I said, hey, I'm Stan Rowe. I'm at J&J. I was wondering, what have you done with your patents? He said, well, I licensed them. I said, oh, really? OK, so who did you license them to? I don't remember.
Really?
I said, really?
Hans is nodding here.
10%.
So I said, on
yeah, so I said, really, you don't know who? He said, no, I've got it here somewhere. I said, why don't you look it up and give me a ring back? And so he gives me a ring back. Oh yeah, it's Stanford Research.
Surgical. No.
Stanford Surgical Research. Yeah. And so...
Which later became Hartport.
Right. And... I said, did you retain any rights? I don't know.
He didn't know.
So I said, if you don't mind, why don't you send me your contract? So he redacted out the pittance that they had paid him, and he sent me the contract, and I looked at it, and sure enough, he had given away all of his rights. So I knew about the Anderson patent then, but then as we started developing, Hartport had gone from being a billion-dollar
market cap
company to something less. And had, I think, licensed one or two things out.
Sure.
So we started a discussion with Casey Tansey and Jan Kontaböder about the Anderson patents. And who were we? I mean, we were nobody with any money, right? And here we are talking about licensing Anderson. But we went at it pretty hard.
Why were the Anderson patents critical? Why were Alan's original patents not sufficient?
We tried to build around, and we finally figured out we need to have it.
Well, we looked at the opportunity to do that, to what were the opportunities to go around. But at the end of the day, if you really read into that, and of course you could read it very narrowly, but if you looked at it, you said, this is the overriding fundamentals of making a collapsible and expandable valve. So, if we're going to succeed, we need to have this legitimacy. We need to buy this patent. And the concept of buying this patent somehow, we didn't have enough money for development, much less a patent, was just daunting. But it didn't keep us from trying. And ultimately, what we ended up doing was using our Series A financing to buy the Anderson rights. And we paid a huge amount of money for them.
Let me get here.
I
cannot sit tight, and I have to tell you.
Because you did the negotiation.
No. That's the whole point. That's what I would like to mention. So, there's another aspect of the whole thing, what we're talking today. We've been together for 24 years now, and we have a great mutual respect, of course, as you can see. But we're very different people, so, And I have to tell you, when we started PVT, and it was already in the fall of year 2000, we worked from Stan's spare room in his house in Inglewood, in New Jersey. And that's where we had all the negotiations. And there were so many times when I was trying to stand enough is enough and enough is enough. And Stan's persistence is just was absolutely unbelievable. I don't think any of our attorneys, and we have a couple of them, were able to read between the lines, whatever he was able to do. It was absolutely unbelievable. And I think I can share with you the terms, I guess, right? And when we first met with Tansy Kenzie, and this is not just, right, it was very interesting. When we first met, the offer was very simple. They said five, five, and five. So they wanted $5 million, 5% of equity of PVT, and 5% royalties.
And I thought Stan's head was going to blow up.
Almost. That's almost so. I said, that's never. But that's what it started. And the other thing, which is very important aspect, and then I'll get you to the point that Stan was able to get, is that Casey Tansy, he said one thing. There is a lot of people who want to get this IP. And for us, and this is his words, he said, for us and for me, it's very important to give it to someone who will really develop the technology. And I will never forget, and Stan and I met him a few years ago at Watto ACC. He was so elated, so happy for us, where we got and whatever. But it was very interesting concept. Of course, money is very important, and they weren't doing very well in the fall of 2000. But that's his word. We want to give it to the companies. Well,
that there were other people interested. Maybe he was just negotiating to pump the price up.
We outbid Edwards Life Sciences.
There are so many companies, and outbid, and then we believe. And
you outbid.
And you've heard the numbers. I said five, five, and five. And Stan was able to get 3.5% of equity at Series A and $3 million cash, $1 million now and $2 million in 2 years. Prepaid completely, exclusive license for the Anderson IP.
Now, ironically, before we move on to the PV, did you have something else you wanted to add?
No, the last thing I would like to tell you, we closed this deal the same day when we closed the Series A, which was in December of 2000. 2 weeks later, we see the announcement that Johnson & Johnson just bought Hartford.
And that's what I was going to say. This brings Johnson & Johnson back into the story.
And we call Casey Stenkel, right? Casey and says, Casey, what happened? He said, you know what? Last time we've heard from J&J was in the summer of 2000. All of a sudden, they came to us in January, whatever, 14, 15, and they said, we would like to buy, you know, and they bought them for $62 million, whatever the IP. So, but anyway, that's part of
it's interesting.
So but it's this guy, I have to tell you, I always pay tribute to people that I work and there's and this is, I think, the biggest thing is the skills and opportunity and the patience. Guys, you have to be patient. I'm not, but it's a combination of people you work together and in the future you work. You have to.
The most Stan's impatience means we got a lot done in a very short period of time, though.
So not that you wouldn't have had to name it, but the Anderson patents were the trigger for you guys to raise your Series A. Tell us a little about that story and where you got the money from. And at that time, was there a lot of skepticism? Did you have to ring a lot of doorbells, or was it easy to raise the capital?
So Stan and I, because we had some background and a lot of people knew us, we could at least visit the top venture capital companies around this area, for example, like Sand Hill Road. And we got in those places, and I always tell people we would come in and tell our story, and people would go, wow, that's interesting. I actually haven't heard this before. You're gonna make a percutaneous heart valve. Yeah, okay, we'll look into it. And my belief always, and I guess I heard back from many, that we would walk out, they'd dial the phone because they weren't the experts. Guess who they would call? Who is the expert in heart valves? The cardiothoracic surgeon.
Right.
And what do the cardiothoracic surgeons say? Let's see, we treat all the patients, we have perfect outcomes, and here's the top 8 reasons why this is never ever going to work. And it's a ridiculous idea. And so it was very, very hard to raise capital.
with the experts. So steadfastly against this idea. And I think they were steadfastly against it because, number one, it was against all their experience. When you cut out aortic stenosis, it's a rock. It just didn't make any sense. Two, they had no background in stents or balloon valvuloplasty. And three, they were scared to death of encroachment. And those three things, I think, really made them, you know, very, very staunch detractors of this idea.
So your Series A capital came from an Israeli investor, and maybe that connection is obvious because of Iran, and also an East Coast investor, Jeff Barnes at Oxford. How did you hook up with both, particularly Jeff Barnes at Oxford?
I think we actually hooked up with him due to Marty.
Through Marty, through CRF,
Marty had sources, and Marty was very involved and knew a lot of people and opened a lot of doors for us, and of course was always a very, very steadfast supporter of this company.
So Jeff Barnes came in, and let's just complete the story. Who was the Israeli investor?
Yuval Ben-Or. He had a small fund there. It was about $150 million. Oxford Bioscience Partners was about $1 billion fund, and we were very pleased to have these guys. They were both really good. Jeff Barnes was very, very thoughtful guy, and as was Yuval. Yuval was a PhD in, I think, laser physics, just a phenomenal guy, and both remain very good friends.
Well, I want to get to the next round of financing because that brings the corporates into it. But I want to talk about what's happening, what was going on in the early 2000s. Before we get to what PVT was doing, what was the general interest in percutaneous valves? Was the idea beginning to catch on? There was one other company, CoreValve, was CoreValve even in the picture at that time? Was anybody else noodling around this idea?
So we knew a lot of people, and we looked around for this technology elsewhere. And I did hear about Jacques Seguin being interested. And I actually called him up. I remember I was in New York when I got his number, and I called up Jacques, and I said, so I hear you're interested in developing transcatheter heart valves. He said, yeah.
And he's a surgeon,
right? And I said, we had this conversation. I found out he was steadfastly against the fundamental principle that Alain Cribier brought to the board, which we should describe. And
yes,
that was the idea that you could stent aortic stenosis out of the way, which was preposterous to most people, right?
Which meant that you were replacing the valve without removing the stenotic valve.
Right. You would just stent this aortic stenosis out of the way. And Jacques said, that'll never work. I said, well, what do you plan to do? He says, well, we're going to develop catheters to cut it out. And that's where we kind of parted ways. And that's what they worked on until the reports of our first in man. And then they changed their mind.
So talk about your first human study. I mean, TCT 2000, Alain Cribier does a presentation that shows success, but there's only a handful of people in the room. By 2002, you're doing your first cadaveric study, and then your first patient comes along. Tell us that story, because that's an interesting story.
You know, even before, just chronologically, I think it'd be good to talk about our failures. Mm-hmm. And Stan, why don't you start, and we'll...
I don't want to go a lot about the failures, but what you just mentioned, the failures, guys, let me start with success, and then I'll tell you the failures, because it will come.
I
think to a certain extent, guys, luck plays a huge role in the life and whatever you do. And I have to tell you from, you know, when we talk about it, the first animal experiments that we had in August of 2000, the very first one, was very successful. In September of months later, when Alain Cribier presented at TCT, that's exactly what you alluded to, there was a presentation about, you know, the new thing, animal study. And in the old convention center of Washington, there was, I think, about 15 people, and I think it's mostly all of us. Nobody was there. And after this very successful case, we definitely done maybe 50, 60 and other animal experiments in Paris and Serrat, the times that we created today, the biggest part called IMM. There was a failure after one, after another, and after another, but eventually we're able to succeed, and then.
But go back to those failures. Did anything about those failures think that maybe this isn't really feasible? That
you know,
you can draw it up and it looks good, but when you take it into the patient, it's not going to work.
Oh sure.
Yeah.
Did you ever think maybe we just shut this thing down?
By the way, that's very important to say. When we did the first animal experiments, and we continue for several of them, we started with polymeric valve, and we didn't know anything about the tissue. And that's another thing that you have to keep in mind. And it took us almost a year working on the tissue, and then on the polymers, and then we switched to tissue. And then it's become,
didn't fail with just one polymer. We failed with lots of polymers. We tried the best polymers, copolymers, hybrid polymers. We did Dacron reinforced. We did electro spinning before anybody knew what it was. Yeah. We tried all kinds of things to make polymers work. Why? Because one, they were available. Two, I was very concerned about tissue thickness and the diameter of these valves. And we thought we could maybe make it work. So it was really hard. So the animal studies, almost impossible. Why? Why were the animal studies impossible? Well, we put them in young, healthy animals, okay? So young, healthy animals don't have aortic stenosis. And this technology is the ultimate in making lemonades out of lemons, right? We take the disease and we use it to anchor the valve. Without the disease, there's no anchoring, right? It takes 30 sutures to implant a surgical heart valve, and we use zero. Why do we use zero? Because we're putting it into a fibrotic calcific disease, and that's what holds it into place, okay? Now, we didn't understand it to that extent at that time. We kept questioning whether we had the right idea. But Cribier had done the fundamental work. He had placed stents in cadaveric hearts, and he told us two things. You get a large valve area, and it takes a pair of pliers to pull them out. It's not a bad proof of principle if you think about it, right? But we did struggle, and it was hard. We developed some good things. We understood better delivery systems that made us think about pulmonic. We tried pulmonic. We tried lots of things. And finally, we ended up putting it in the descending aorta. We took a biotome around, and we ripped out an aortic leaflet. If you did that in a normal animal, it'll die in minutes. And so if you rip out an aortic leaflet, it creates a gradient. The valve functions. And that's how we did our five-month implant prior to first.
But I wanted to get to, if I have the story right, in April 2002, within days of doing your first cadaveric study, you were suddenly presented with Alan Cribier coming to you saying he had a patient that he wanted to implant this technology on. That had to be a turning point, because the question was whether you were ready for that.
Yeah, so I actually did a TED talk on this where I bare my soul, but it was really tough because Cribier, again, we were a couple of months before we had planned to do our first in man, and Alain called up and he said, I need the valve. I said, so why? He said, well, I have a patient who's dying, and if I don't have it, he'll die. I said, well, tell me about it. He says, so the guy's 57 years old, 57. He has a 10% ejection fraction, which I didn't even know you could live with a 10% EF, but that's how big his LV was. And he had a failed aortobifemoral graft. He was in cardiogenic shock. He shows up in Rouen. He's been turned down by two surgical teams. And Cribier does balloon valvuloplasty on him, and he's back in shock the next day. So this guy's dying. And so the question is, do you want to take this technology you've worked on for several years, and this is going to be your first patient? How do you make that decision? You risk your company on this kind of patient. And it was really hard. You know, I ran it by Stan, I ran it by Marty, and you know, at the end of the day, it was more of an ethical decision than it was a business decision.
To try to save that patient's life at all.
You know, that's what we did this for. Ultimately, I think, you know, a lot of what you learn at J&J, a lot of what we learn maybe in our lives, is that if you're not creating value for patients, nothing else works.
And fortuitously, that the valve worked on that patient, but your next several cases, they weren't all successes.
Well, you start with that. So you say, we had an opportunity to save a life, and we went after that. And this guy was a train wreck, and not only, so remember I said he had a failed aortobifemoral graft, so everything we had done was transfemoral. That was our plan. We couldn't do a transfemoral procedure, so just for fun, we had to do a transseptal procedure, which had never been done, and the guy had a thrombus in his LV just to make it exciting. But Cribier does this case. The guy goes into asystole even during the case, and he proceeds to deliver this valve, and this guy turns from ashen and gray to pink in an hour. And that night, he's sitting up having a glass of champagne with Cribier talking with him. It was a miracle. And that's one of the blessings of this technology. It is, it has such a profound early impact on patients.
But do you have a sense of why the next several dozens or so cases didn't have the same success rate?
Oh, yeah. Very clearly. They were all just like this guy. They were coming in. They were train wrecks.
Oh,
right?
So some were just...
As Marv used to say, they had, one foot in the grave on the other and on a banana peel, so they were in terrible condition. And so and this was the challenge. We were criticized for this, right? You take a brand new technology, and I'm going through this right now, by the way, with transcatheter mitral, and that is that you have a brand new technology, no one's ever used it before, the risk benefit has to make sense. And the risk benefit made sense for these compassionate cases, right? But it also puts a huge pressure on the technology to figure out, does it work? What does it work in an ideal patient? So there's no easy answer here.
And in fact, in a very celebrated case, at TCT a couple of years later, a patient didn't survive one of the live cases.
Yeah, we had a patient who came in about 3 years later who, I had the gift of meeting this lady, and she was amazing. She talked about how, she had had previous bypass. She was diabetic. She had had multiple stents. She was...
7 years, she lived.
Yeah, this lady was...
She was
a train wreck, and she got this valve, and she talked about how she did summers with her family in the south of France, and it just, it not only changed her, but it changed her whole family. And that
it
was
is one
the
of the
impact.
Interesting things about the perseverance, the kind of going through these successive failures. I want to move along here. 2002, you raise your next round of capital, and it's very interesting because at a time when today in particular we're talking so much about getting corporates involved earlier and on, you guys had a very interesting Series B financing, which had several competitors sitting on your board at one time. Talk about your Series B and how you wound up with Boston Scientific, Medtronic, and Johnson & Johnson on your board at one time.
Tell them about our board meeting. So Stan and I had already hatched this plan. Tell them about our board meeting.
It was really fun. It was interesting. the whole Series B, I can say a few words who came and how we decided to raise. So the first case was done. It was April 16, 2002. We have a few cases, and it's already fall. It was at AHA of 2002, November, when I think it started a little bit early. We decided to raise money. And this is interesting, we approached Medtronic. And why we approached Medtronic? Because at one point, I think it was at ACC, Bill Hawkins, as you know, just joined Medtronic together with Steve Osterley. And when Stan and I came, I think it was even summer of 2000, we came to see them and the rest of the crew and management of Medtronic when we made this presentation, and we left, and of course, everybody was very much against it. But luckily to us, it was Bill Hawkins and Steve who knew us, and Bill always believed in percutaneous heart valve, was very, very supportive. So he kind of pushed everything, and they decided, and not just to give us to raise money, but they decided to lead. And that's what happened. And we decided to raise, we calculated about $11 million. And they said, we're going to put $5 million. And our guys, they said, we're going to put four, And so we were looking for another $2 million, and at AHA, we had we met with Paul LaViolette at the drink at the, in Chicago, I remember, and we said, so we're looking for another couple million dollars. Are you interested, Boston Scientific? Interesting. He said, you know, let me go back. I'll talk to Larry Best, and we'll decide what to do. We came back and got the call, and asked Stan if he can go and join Larry Best for a very short conversation. So you can finish your conversation there.
So. Well, so I went up there and presented, and of course it was interesting. So we started Medtronic, got in first. Steve Osterley was really an important advocate. Their heart valve division told them they were idiots to make an investment and thought this was never gonna work and it was a really bad idea. But they decided they would do it anyway. I give them credit for that. But then when I went to see Boston, because Stan and I had already decided we wanted two strategics because we didn't want one because it looked like somebody owned you. And since J&J already owned a piece of PVT, because remember they had bought Hartport, and Hartport owned 3.5% of PVT, they were already had observation rights. So,
sorry, I just would like to mention, at 2002 in December, we have to make second payment to Hartford,
right,
to J&J, December, $2 million. So that's why we need to.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I went up to Boston and presented to just like three or four people there, and you know it was amazing. So Paul leaves the room, says, "Excuse me a minute." Walks in, talks to Larry, comes back out, and says, "Okay, here's the deal. We'll invest, but we want to own exactly the same number of shares as Medtronic." I said, "Okay."
So. We didn't want to. We didn't want this money, but it happened. The decision was made in a couple hours. So it was interesting. But so by the end of the day, of course, by January of 2003, we had on our board, we had from Medtronic was Steve Osterley, and from Boston Sci, we had Paul LaViolette.
And J&J observation.
And J&J observation. They didn't participate anyway, so that's J&J. So I think he came just once or twice to the board meeting. But that was very important for the future because our board is really, it was, you know, Stan, myself, it was Marv Woodall, who was independent, and it was Avi Zakai and two other original VCs and one top guy from Medtronic, another top guy from Boston Sci.
So I want to get to... because Edwards comes in 2003. Did you try to raise money from non-corporate investors at this time, or between the corporates and your existing internal guys, did you not even try?
Well, we actually turned down Patanga, remember?
Yeah.
Oh, you turned down Patanga?
Patanga wanted to, yeah.
They came in late.
They had an opportunity to do it, and then we came to Boston, and Boston decided, and we said no to them.
Okay. So 2003 is a critical year. You guys are starting your clinical trials, and you're going to the FDA, but late in the year, or sometime during that year, Edwards comes into the picture. Now, Edwards had a chance to invest, but didn't.
That's right.
Early on. Talk about how Edwards became involved in the company.
Get into the September of 2003 at your breakfast at TCT with...
Well, even before that, I mean, I can't say. So, you know, we approached Edwards for tissue, and... came really close to reaching an agreement with them, and then it kind of got blown up in business development that they kind of overextended, and we just decided to walk away, and that's where we ended up sourcing tissue from a company down the street from Edwards called 3F Therapeutics, and that's where we actually reached a really nice agreement with them to source tissue and actually help with manufacturing as well. But you know, after we had done some of these cases, I think it really changed Edwards' perspective because they didn't, as most people who were heart valve experts, they came to believe that this was possible and potentially disruptive. And so I did what any CEO should do, and I went and I called Mike Masalem up for September for an... 2003, which was right at TCT time, and I said, "Let's have breakfast." He said, "Okay." So I sat down with Mike and I said, "You know, Mike, PVT should be an Edwards company." He said, "Really, why?" I said, "Well, because it's very simple." I said, "We offer the biggest threat and the biggest opportunity to Edwards. You're the leading heart valve company in the world."
Now, they have their own internal Perkinator's effort. Did they know much about what you guys were doing?
Oh, yeah. I mean...
Oh, they knew.
They did.
And we knew what they did, too.
Yeah, we knew what they were doing, too.
So what was Mike's response to that? Obviously, yes.
So Mike said, well, one thing. He said, I wouldn't want to be a stalking horse to all these other guys, because they were bigger. You know, he didn't want to... Meaning, he didn't want me to provoke a bidding war with Medtronic and Boston and others who could outbid him. So I said, well, if I could solve that problem for you, would you be interested? He said, yeah. So we left it at that, and I came back and hatched another plan. And that was that I took a motion to the board of directors that said, if any strategic made an offer towards the company, we would have a subcommittee of the board that would evaluate those independent of the board, because certain of the board had conflicts. And
did this raise red flags with Paul and Steve that
yes.
Why are you asking, why do you want to do this right now?
Well, it did raise some flags, and Paul was the captain of his debate team, and it was not an easy conversation, but I actually got them both to agree. I'm still not sure how. But we came back, and you know, the obvious thing was this. So think about it, right? So if we got a term sheet from Edwards, we would have to evaluate it and take it to the board, right?
Right.
So we can receive a term sheet. So we sat down, talked with Edwards as a subcommittee, and we said, you want to buy this company, here's what it costs. And don't send us a term sheet. We'll have to reach an agreement right now.
And right now?
Meaning
yeah, the timing
within the next 3 weeks.
Let me just chronologically, just very quickly. The first meeting that Stan just described, it was September 15th, I guess, of 2003. The meeting between our subcommittees that we created at PVT, which Stan was there representing management, Barnes represented investor, and Mar Woodall was like independent, three of them. They flew to Chicago O'Hare Airport, and Mike with his two other guys came there, and that's where they had this. It happened on November 14th. That's where Stan mentioned that, you know, guys, if you want, and there was the price, and when he left, the only thing, my participation in this discussion was that the price will be $10 a share. And that's what Stan delivered. So it was November 14th. And the closing of the deal happened in my office, in our office in Fort Lee, 4 weeks later on December 12th.
4 weeks. Now, so this no is term sheet. That means we did that many documents in that period of time. We negotiated all those things, and we never had a term sheet. So we negotiated that, and then I sent that whole stack to the entire board and said, we have 72 hours to agree, and we have a board meeting coming up. We're going to meet at the board.
Regular board meeting.
Regular board meeting. 12th. The subcommittee recommends approval of this deal. And we have this offer expires in 72 hours. So Boston and Medtronic and J&J all had 72 hours to make up their minds whether they wanted to do this a better deal than what Edwards put on the table or not.
And when Stan mentioned so much documents, it was just about one thing. What if there will be, if someone else will come in and try to make another offer? Because the agreement was there was nothing to negotiate. There was a price and there was nothing. The only, I think the business development guy wanted to get, we had a lot of cash. We didn't spend a lot of money.
Could any of those corporates have blackballed the deal by a single vote? No, or? What kind of buy-in did you have to have from Boston and Medtronic to
I think we needed one of them to say yes.
They supported it.
I heard a rumor once that Boston was in fact interested, but just couldn't in 72 hours pull the deal together.
No. I would say it was the other way around.
Opposite. Yeah. Medtronic wouldn't. J&J would not even consider because they have to get together. It will take a week. But for Boston. Boston could make a decision very, because Paul LaViolette, guys, maybe some of you definitely know Paul, but he's a very classy guy. He flew it, it's Friday, it's December 12th. He flew into our board meeting in the office. And he came in and he was there for a couple hours, signed the documents, voted, and then congratulated us and left, fly back to Boston. And when we talked to him and I asked him the question, so what actually happened there? And what he told us that they had a discussion for a couple hours with Tobin and Larry Best, and they decided through fiduciary obligations, whatever, the offer that Edwards gave to us is much better right away because it was 80%, it was all cash and all the deal. They said it will be different from us. We definitely can give you much more on the back end than it will be, but, and then he said something else. So I still hope that we'll work together and in anticipation or in what they had in mind, let them get into Edwards and then we'll acquire Edwards. It was kind of underlining, but they both guided, and that's now, that's what's over.
Understand, we had, how much had we spent to that point?
So the whole thing we spent, we still have $8 million in the bank, so the total money that we spent develop what we have developed with IP that
with
we...
With buying IP.
With buying $3 million
with,
in IP.
With $3 million was $11 million.
So the question is, you just had done a very successful financing. You raised more money than you thought you were going to raise. Why sell at that time?
Well, there's no better time to sell than when you have money in the bank.
Because it was offered, because we said...
But...
We didn't have to. That's the
you
point.
You didn't have to, so why...
We didn't want to, right?
So...
No, there is a reason. I'm sorry, Stan. Let me remind you one thing. In the summer of 2003... And that's where I learned something about VCs and everything. In summer of 2003, the guy from the Fleming, who ran the Oxford Bioscience, he asked Stan and me to come to Boston. He wanted to talk to us. And here we had a very interesting discussion and all this stuff, and he said, guys, you have to understand that you are vintage of 1999. I didn't know this term related to this one, then I figured out. And you know, it's about time for us, we have to go back to our original investors for 99, and how about you selling the company? I said, and we said, no, you know, this is the curve, right? We more time, more, we create the value. And see, there, I remember he asked, what kind of value? I said, no, I said, hopefully by the end of next year, year 2004, maybe we can get $10. He said, what? We just raised the money, it was $230. And that's how we end up. And then when Stan was going there on November 14, I said, don't forget the number, it's the $10. $10 a share.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So that's why one of the things that we decided to address, because one of our original VCs asked, you know, we said we don't want to, we're just in the process of creating more value.
So you went from $2.30 to $10 per share at the exit.
On the series
B. The exit was $125 million with a $30 million buyout. And again, like Stan said, we had spent $11 million and we had a bunch of money in the bank, which we distributed against the preferred as well. So it was actually effectively, you know, a good bit more than that.
So it was a couple of years later, but when Medtronic bought CoreValve, they paid significantly more than 100, like five times more.
$700 million.
Any sense that you guys underpriced the deal or had you waited?
No, the ratio was the same for the investors.
That's right.
The same thing. They paid $700. We don't know how it's ended up, by the way, yet. But they paid $700 and they spent about $70 million.
We're close up against time. I want to get to two integration issues.
Oh.
Because one, which I will defer for a second, was that you guys are still working for Edwards, which I think has got to be certainly the most unusual thing that I've seen in this industry that you guys would survive. Before we get to that, Edwards was very deep into its own internal project. What was the first integration efforts like? Was there, yes, Mike and Stu Foster and John Keel really want to do this deal, but when you got back into Edwards and were lining up your project against what they were doing, was there any pride of ownership here? Was there any sense of two teams looking at each other saying, what makes you think your stuff is so great because we've already got the superior technology? What was those first discussions with Edwards' internal percutaneous valve team like?
Well, I think they were very smart. I mean, first of all, we created this thing called PVI, percutaneous valve interventions, and that's where all of the technology resided. And so they put me in charge of that, so it was kind of like, okay, you go figure it out. Whatever you want to do, just let's go make this work. And so we got to beg, borrow, and steal and figure out what the best solution was. And
but were you not perceived as an outsider with a bias toward PVT?
I think that was part of my job, maybe as the manager, is to make sure everybody was on board and that we did this in a respectful manner and listened to everybody. And you know, it went really well. And I think that it was probably the textbook integration. One of the things, one anecdote that I think is one of those things for any of you who have to go through this. You know, it's really tough when you give up your company, right? But when somebody buys you, how do you feel a part of it? One of the things that Edwards did that I thought was one of the classiest things in the world, they put a big banner out in the middle of the cafeteria. There's 2,000 employees on campus. And it said, "Welcome to the Edwards family," and every person on the campus signed it, and they sent it to Israel. And they hung it up over the wall there that said, "Welcome." And it was, you know, I mean, really a touching, meaningful thing for everybody there. And the great news was all the PVT people were retained.
For many years.
We've tripled the size of that research unit, which still resides in Caesarea. And they've created huge value for Edwards Life Sciences as we move forward. Sapien 3, which is an amazing percutaneous valve, came out of Israel.
So obviously, you know, you've done a lot of development, but when you think about that first Sapien valve that came out, how much did it look more like the PVT valve or did it look more like the internal Edwards valve?
It is. It's only Americans. There's nowhere else you can find Sapien these days. It's only in the United States.
So the Sapien valve
is the PVT valve with the tissue developed by Edwards.
But with a much better delivery system.
Delivery system, right. But that's still PVT valve, unfortunately. But it's only in the United States. Very, very, very unique.
So
you know, this is very, very dear to me, and I always mention this one, and people who were at the other, Casey was there at the panels, I always pay a certain tribute to people who deserve it. It looked like it was relatively easy for Edwards kind of to come and to acquire us, but it wasn't easy for one person, and I think his name is Mike Musallam. Because when Mike's idea was to acquire PVT, he brought it to his management and he wanted to get their approval or support. And nobody supported him. There was a couple people were on the fence. There is no support. Then he decided to go to advisory board of Edwards Life Sciences. And one of the top advisors of this board, I don't know if you've heard him, Tom Fogarty. And Tom said, "No way, it's not going to work."
Along with every other surgeon.
Every other surgeon. And then Mike went to the board of directors and said, "Guys, I need to acquire PVT because I believe in this one and we have to have it." And they asked him, "So did you get approval from your boards or whatever?" Said, "No." And at that time, Edwards didn't have any penny in the bank. They had to borrow every dollar that they pay. And I always pay huge tribute, and you see what has become with Edwards Life Sciences, and it's all behind Mike Musallam. So and the other thing, just as Stan already mentioned, it was 21 people where they acquired PVT just a couple of years ago. We still have about 18. Now we still have 12 people from original PVT, and it was 10 years since the acquisition, which happened in January. And all the top manager of the original PVT still part of Edwards, and it's great, and this is absolutely unique integration that ever happened.
So that's a great way to end. That's a fantastic story, and it's really been a fascinating story. Talk about that, because I think that really is unusual. 12 of the 21 still there. Why are you guys still there? I mean, you must have had other opportunities, other things that intrigued you. Do you think you found a home at Edwards? Or do you think that the project that you started 15 years ago, that journey's not yet complete? Why is it, the question why you're still there is is asked against the background that so many executives in your place would have left a long time ago. You've now spent almost twice as much time at Edwards as you did at PVT, right? 5 and 10.
Well, I think
it's a 10-year.
Yeah, I think two things. I mean, I think one, we were treated with tremendous respect there,
absolutely,
which was enormous. Two, Stan and I both share a lot of things. We're closer than most brothers, but we share a passion for